Miami.
Hello and welcome to Dynamite Neddy. It's the Retro Games Podcast where a couple of OW pals get together and talk about a couple of OW games. The voice you're hearing just now is myself, Mr. Mick Clockerty. Joining me, as always, we have Mr. Mick McCormick.
How's it going?
And Mr. Andy Mack.
Karichiwa.
Well, boys, there have been many evil gatherings in human history. You've got the assassination of JFK, when all the senators gathered round to stab him to death, or, like, not the assassination of JFK.
A few about 2,000 years too late.
The assassination of Julius Caesar, when all the senators gathered round to stab him to death. Or the Nuremberg rally, where the Nazis got together. You see all that horrible footage of it. And last week, we had another to add to the list. Dawn's 40th.
I think the less said about Dawn's 40th, the better.
I knew as soon as I walked in that there was going to be a fucking issue with Dawn's 40th. To get context, McCormick got engaged a wee while ago, and this was his party. And they failed to tell him that there's going to be an upstairs and downstairs aspect to this building. So there's going to be two concurrent parties happening at the same time.
We were upstairs in the engagement party, a.k.a. Heaven, where you're just catering chicken curry, macaroni and cheese, people dead shots of Sambuca. Happiness, love, support, good vibes. Downstairs, you had Dawn's 40th, which was, I don't know, characterised by DJ Rankin, cocaine, and aggro, it would be fair to say.
See that bit of No Fucking Blade? See you to start. See when they're all fucking jumping about and fucking some kind of walks on a stage with like blood and all that and all these fucking sprinklers start pissing blood. I'd imagine that's what Dawn's 40th was like.
From dusk till Dawn's 40th.
I think Dawn had a blood rave at her 40th, I.
I was expecting a Terminator to turn up looking for Sarah Connor.
I had to get something done about Dawn's 40th just for a bit of posterity there. Keep it in the public consciousness.
I'm already dreading her 50th, man. It's another 10 years away.
Let's get away from aggressive Greenock social events and on to what he's been up to. Has anybody been playing anything in the last wee while of note?
I found it very hard to drag myself away from Vardenfell.
I've been the same. I've been locked into Morrowind. Like an old pal I haven't seen for a wee while. We've been going to the pub every day and catching up.
In tech news, I guess I did buy a new PC, traded myself with a PC. The Chinese, great bunch of lads that they are, they've managed to make PCs that are like the size of two decks of cards sitting next to each other.
Aye.
But somehow have like 64 gig of RAM in Ryzen processors and that. And so yeah, just get yourself an AliExpress.
Have you done the ground up thing and bought all the different parts and then just stuck it together yourself?
No, it's literally just comes in a box, a tiny wee box, and then it's all integrated. Pretty impressive. I've not really done any gaming on it yet. It's been using it from a studio, but I any latency or anything sounding brand new.
Aye.
The only thing I guess is that because it's like a tiny micro PC, you can't use any of your sort of tech savvy. If anything goes wrong, you can open it up and replace it. It's pretty much just like a black box.
Aye.
If something goes wrong with it, I think it's completely fucked.
How do they stop a GPU if it burned itself into the centre of the earth and without a fan and all that stuff?
Well, it does have a fan inside it. You occasionally hear it wearing up. It's not none of your liquid cooling or any of that nonsense.
Oh, so it's like a low profile thing.
Aye, not much power draw either.
No, I got a fucking, see one of them old Dell Optiplexes you used to get in the offices?
That's how you get your best deals on laptops. See if somebody is like refurbishing an office and they stick like 50 Dell laptops on eBay, you'll get yourself a pure bargain.
See this one I've got here, I bought a Dell Optiplex 7010, right? And what it is, it's just a wee tower that you would normally see in an office block, but it's got like 16 gigabyte of RAM, man. It's fucking rapid. It's brilliant. It's a desktop PC, and if you put a GPU in it, you can play like games for like, maybe 3-4 years ago.
Pretty good.
But the only thing is, you've got to get a low profile one, because the big ones don't fit in it, because the case is too wee, essentially. But, I mean, you can get one of them for like fucking £200.
Aye.
And then the GPU on top, mate, maybe £200 as well. And then about £400, you've got just as good a gaming PC as we can buy for like £1,500 just now.
It's because all the innovation's going on in, like, mobile phones, which means that they have to make stuff that's, like, way smaller and way less power-intensive. But nowadays you get a PC that's, like, a fucking 20th of the size as it was 10 years ago, and it runs twice as fast.
The best option nowadays to play PC games is just to get a Steam Deck in it and plug it into the telly. That way you're not paying, like, $3,000.
That's pretty magic.
It's a great thing. I mean, for the likes of myself, who I wouldn't be tech-savvy, something that just that you can just put in your horns and then go, oh, I'm going to download a couple of the latest games, and then I can just fucking sit and play them then and there. I've not really got the wherewithal to know what would make a good gaming PC or what magic Chinese computers to buy. And then, although it would appeal to me to annoy Ross Greer, but I'll need to stick to getting chow mains out of Lung Fun for now.
I do occasionally see these wee specky head popping up behind my hedge just to check out what I'm doing. I'm like, bugger off, Ross.
We're not officially a Maoist podcast, but I don't know, it's been flirted with a couple of times.
Resident G's been paying my paychecks for the past 5 years.
Andy, have you been playing anything yourself or just night shift mode?
Talking about me, I'm still having a wee shot of Final Fantasy XIV in my spare time. I've been playing quite a bit of this game the other day in the day.
I've not been playing much myself, just a bold Morrowind. I'm seething with jealousy today because my old man has been at Dundalk over in Ireland for the races this weekend, and then he's sending me
Oasis?
Pictures. What, sorry?
Oasis?
The racing.
Oh, right. For some reason, I fucking got a picture of a big gym man, the mosh pit with fucking Liam Gallagher. No.
Horses, they've probably got a wee bit more sentience, Gallagher brothers. But he was in Dundalk for the races and sent me a couple of pictures and videos of him the day. Fucking Croke Park, drinking pints of Guinness at a game of Gaelic. It was Dublin versus Tyrone. I've always wanted to go there.
Class, man. Aye. Croke Park's that one with the. It's got that Falkirk Stadium thing where they built three sides of it and that one side's like tiny in it.
No, there's one side that's kind of just like a wee makeshift stand. The rest of it is... It's like Irish Wembley. It's their equivalent. It's only used for Gaelic sports. Seats 100,000 people, something like that. Crazy big. But aye, they have got a wee daft temporary stand looking thing behind one of the goals.
Oh, cool. Wee bit of character.
Will we just get a show on the road then? Will we get... stuck right into our games, unless anybody's got anything further to say about Don's 40th, or...
I'd rather forget about it.
I've got plenty to say about Don's 40th, but I'll be keeping that when we're not on the podcast.
Aye. Right, we will kick off with... Well, do you know, when I played this game, it was just known as Metal Gear Solid for a Game Boy Color, but I think now... To distinguish it, it goes by, it might have just originally been a Japanese title, Metal Gear Solid Ghost Babel for the Game Boy Color. Mr. McCormick, why did you pick this shin for Andy Mac?
Yeah, I'm going to call it that on the episode title, because I don't want to get folk too excited thinking we're playing one of the greatest games of all time. Yeah, I remember playing this back in the day. I emulated it because I never actually had a Game Boy Color. The Game Boy Advance was the first Game Boy adjacent console that I ever had. I was a massive fan of the PS1 game. And I remember kind of playing this at the time, there was a lot of hyper in it, and I was quite impressed by just how they managed to like translate a lot of the stuff via the PS1 game onto a tiny wee Game Boy Color. I thought it was pretty cool, although I don't know how much of that was borrowed from the original games on the MSX and stuff. The PS1 Metal Gear Solid is incredible. I think it's maybe a bit too weighty of a topic for just a Vincent Totti's episode, so I decided to get a kind of cut-down version for Andy's experience.
Aye, cut down version is something that this game definitely doesn't fucking embody in itself. This game, I went into the same as you, like, this is just going to be like the old Metal Gear games for the NES, where aye, it's going to be top down. It's going to be a bit like kind of Pac-Man, where you've got to like, avoid the guys walking about, get them from the back and try and get from A to B. But this game was a lot more than that, and sort of ways that I enjoyed and ways that I didn't enjoy, right? I'll probably just go into how I started the game when I booted up the emulator, because I kind of couldn't believe it was happening at first. So this game begins with a sequence, right? A sequence that goes on and on and on and on
it really
and
does.
On and 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 on. I think it clocks in about fucking 15 minutes, and this sets the story up about what's going to be happening in the game, essentially, what the conceit of the game is about. Now, I know that fucking Metal Gear games are always story intensive, but I forgot how fucking much, man. But the story's, I quite enjoy the story, but it's just the way it's told is really, like, weird.
You kind of don't expect to see it coming through a Game Boy screen. Like most Game Boy games you play, you just press start and that's it, boom, you're in level one. Whereas in this, you've got the Colonel talking to Snake about how a Metal Gear's been lost and captured by some militia, and you've got to go and get it back to prevent nuclear war, and he gives you the whole briefing of the mission and stuff.
But the game is about 7 years after the events of the first game, when Snake obviously smashed the Metal Gear. He has, as he always has, been called out of retirement to investigate sort of breakaway kind of rebel mob in a place called Gindra, which is near the Central African Republic. But the story sort of talks about a Metal Gear that's sitting in Gindra that's going to be activated by this rebel group. But the story goes on to, like, talk about how the USA are interfering with Gindra's kind of drive for independence, and this rebel group are only trying to ready the Metal Gear in order to rid the kind of US influence for, like, stopping them from getting said independence. So I kind of found myself rooting against Snake throughout this game.
This is kind of classic Kojima stuff here. He's always kind of got some sort of political message to kind of smuggle in. One of his interests, his special interests, kind of smuggled into the plot. Like, Metal Gear games have always had a kind of pacifist message, like an anti-war message, like, of the ridiculousness of nuclear war and stuff like that, and I think this one's the obsession.
Aye, but that's the thing. The game is trying to set up, like, this horrible Gindra Liberation Front that I pictured as, like, kind of the fucking child soldiers thing for the Central African Republic and Congo and that. But kind of been framed as this evil fucking rebel mob that wanted to become warlords and blow up the whole world for nothing and that. But when you actually look at what they're saying, they're hiring Snake to get in so that the Yanks can fucking take over a wee bit of country and fucking hammer all the resources, take the threat away of the Metal Gear, because that's the only thing stopping the Yanks from sort of having influence over it.
Usually, in any given Metal Gear Solid game, apart from when you get to maybe 4 and 5, there tends to be a part in the plot where Snake realises that he's not a good guy, or rather, his bosses probably aren't the good guys, but, you know, he's just a soldier. What can he do about these kind of mere grand affairs going on?
Does the first game take place in 2002, didn't it? Something like that.
Oh, I don't know when it's set. I think it came out in 98 or 97 or something, I want to say, Metal Gear Solid.
Something like that. So this game takes place 7 years after that. And basically, it has Snake travelling to this region of Gindra in order to infiltrate a rebel base where a brand new Metal Gear is being prepared to launch havoc upon mankind and the world. But I kind of, as I said, found myself rooting against Snake for not only that reason, but also he has sort of interactions with a lot of female characters in this game. And all he does is fucking, like, all he does is, like, compliment them on, like, their tits, compliment them on their looks, and the kind of superficial aspects of them. Says things like, that's my girl, not bad for a woman. He meets this lassie called Mei Ling, and he says, aye. And she gives him, like, a big kind of diatribe about electives in college and why she became, like, a special agent and all that. Talks about extensive background checks, and she had to defeat, like, 1,000 people in the application process to finally get this influential post. The Snake says, you've been speaking to her for a long time, but all I could think about is how much you look like an anime character.
Aye. I mean, famously in Metal Gear Solid, you get this character called Meryl, who's Snake's love interest, who, in order to sort of survive during the events of the Shadow Moses incident, she disguises herself as one of the Genome soldiers. But Snake can tell who she is, that she's not one of the soldiers, because he looks at her arse. She's got a nice wiggle, and the game points this out to you in a cutscene. It's like, look at her arse.
Aye, this is another thing. It's kind of classically Kojima. If you remember, he was talking about Police Knots a few months ago as well. I think the main characters in his games, like Snake, are like a guy whose name I can't remember, fucking Mel Gibson for Police Knots. Seem to be a kind of author insert a wee bit, a game and it's used to leer at women.
The problem is, Kojima wouldn't be as much of a genius if he wasn't a pervert. And I firmly believe that. So you just got to let him go. Aye.
Mm, aye, is that a Roman Polanski situation, is it?
As a podcast, I'm no signing off on that we're the podcast that said Kojima's a beast. I'll no say Kojima's a pedo. Just, he's got a kind of old school, Benny Hill stuff. Do you know, like a big fat guy chasing a woman in a bikini about, like, that's dead funny.
Aye, you'd probably be in one of like Lemon Party shock sites or something, that type of thing. but anyways, aye, I'll finish talking about the story and then I'll go into what I actually enjoyed about the game and how it played. So, aye, so you meet this lassie called Mei Li, who's quite a high-up special agent. He's talking about how to infiltrate this enemy base in Gindra, and you finally do that. You go through, sort of, you start off, you kind of parachute in this weird kind of jungle land where it's just full of rebels, and you sort of go into the base and sort of work your way through what are just normal levels. Now, Metal Gear usually gives you like an open world type of thing, but these are just the stages A to B, which I quite enjoyed.
I was actually quite surprised when you playing that, where it's like you finish the first bit and it's like stage one complete.
Aye.
It's like not necessarily an interconnected world like Shadow Moses was in the PlayStation game.
Aye. Once you get into the base, you meet somebody called Kris Jenner, who is another woman. Kris Jenner is a member of Delta Force, who came in before Snake was drafted in to try and get the Metal Gear. Everybody died except her. So she goes on about this big kind of story about how all her friends died and like, the love of her life was on the plane, and she's fucking devastated and she just wants to get these fucking rebel bastards now and all that stuff. And then again, Snake just turns in and says, well, you know, for somebody that's been in a plane crash, I'm not that bad on the eye. Solid Snake with another solid line. She goes on and she tells you about like the sort of aspects of the rebel force that you've not been told about. And on one face, it's just a normal rebel group that you would see in Central Africa, a Western-funded militia that want to become warlords in order to keep their hold on the materials on the land that they then give to the Western countries for a small fee.
The leader is Mark Thatcher, I believe.
Aye, well, it's just the same as any other kind of Central African nation that's resource rich. But what you find is there's also a kind of a cult aspect to this group. There's a cult part of this group, kind of like the Viril Society, called the Black Chamber. Black Chamber is a group of baddies who secretly run the rebel force, but they have their own kind of supernatural abilities in true Metal Gear style. So, for instance, you have Marionette Owl, who's a master of nocturnal combat. Slasher Hawk, who has a giant boomerang that always comes back to his horn, no matter how hard they throws it. Pyro Bison, who says he has a flamethrower he likes to call Scorched Earth, which I think is pretty cool. And Viper, who cries about a poisonous snake like Jake the Snake Roberts.
What about Boomer Kuwanger? Is he one of them?
Aye.
Or Kill Penguin?
Well, Viper is the leader of this crew, and they're all former USA Special Forces. So you get a bit of that vibe for Apocalypse Now, where, what is his name, Colonel Kutz, is it?
Aye.
Gone Native.
Colonel Kutz, where they were Special Forces, they went in with the right intentions, and now they've became sort of the driving force of the Rebel Army.
Hold on, the right intentions. They were working for the Yanks before, then assassinations and regime change and that. I don't know if they were ever good people. It's just that now their interests don't align with NATO, which is why you're parachuting in Solid Snake.
That's it. So Solid Snake's trying to reverse this progress being made by these quote-unquote baddies, when the baddies are just trying to kind of liberate the area, aye?
Oh no, we are a Maoist podcast now.
See, another thing I loved about this was the soldier part. Now, I don't know if they're the same guys throughout the game, right? But there's Soldier A and Soldier B in this game, right? And I don't know if this happens in the other Metal Gear games, it's been ages since I played them, but they have a banter with each other when you're hiding with them. Soldier A and Soldier B will just appear in these rooms and like a wee text will pop up and say, has your wife made you a decent coffee today compared to yesterday? And Soldier B's like, no, it's still muck or something like that. And then they go, when's time, what time's lunchtime today and all that? And you see a guy checking his watch and all that, which is quite good for Game Boy Color.
You've got a guy called Johnny Sazaki, in Metal Gear Solid, Metal Gear Solid 2. Metal Gear Solid 3, it's his granda who worked for the Red Army, but he's a kind of funny guard who, like, shites himself. And I think in Metal Gear Solid 2, you see him doing a piss off a balcony and stuff like that. So there usually is a funny guard character.
I think there's a weird kind of thing, like, can you smell something about McDonald's? They don't say McDonald's, but it's like, can you smell American cuisine or something like that? And guys like that, I can actually, that's weird. And something, this is something about, like, the boss must be hungry again or something. It's quite funny. I just like sitting and listening to Soldier A and Soldier B. And it's funny because they appear everywhere. Like, it doesn't matter where you're, the same sprite. So if you go to, like, one side of the level, it's still Soldier A and Soldier B having a blather, so they're kind of ubiquitous about the whole map, which I thought was quite funny. It's as if they're the only two baddies. But I got to a point in this game where that's about the extent of the story I kind of managed to get to, because I was just getting kind of frustrated with the nuts and bolts of the game, which I'll get into now. So this is a stealth game, as we know. I mentioned earlier, I get serious Pac-Man vibes off it. You basically got the main world where you can see everything that's going on, the dynamics, you can see the sprites, you can see the wee guys walking about, you can see yourself, you can see your HUD on the right hand side with what gun you've got, your health and your evasion counter as well. But on the other side, which I found myself looking at the most, is the map. And the map shows where you are, and the map shows where the enemies are. And if you think about Pac-Man with the wee ghost move about, then I was kind of looking at the map in order to kind of move myself about, rather than looking at the main screen. And I never noticed that before. How close Metal Gear Solid can be to Pac-Man.
So this plays like the old Metal Gear on the MSX and ported to the NES. It's this top-down stealth thing, but they added in a few things for PlayStation. You're saying, like, different parts of the HUD, like the alarm levels and stuff. See, on the map, I can't remember, I played this back in the day, do you get the cone of vision for the soldiers like you did in the PlayStation?
No, on this one. It's just like the dots, as Andy was saying, a big dot for you and a small dot for each guard.
Aye.
But yeah, like the 3D games, especially Metal Gear 1, it kind of is a 2D like game in a way, like Metal Gear Solid 1. Like, the map is really, you could pretty much just look at the radar and, like, play the game that way. It's just a kind of jazzed up 3D and sitting on top of it.
When you point your gun, you can only fire in, like, 8 directions, really. Well, you can't really aim it.
I mean, the thing that got me about the shooting more than anything else was there's no lethal force in this game, so you can only incapacitate your enemy for a certain amount of time. You can't kill them. If you kill them, you can technically kill them, but another one just spawns through outside the screen and comes back in again. So that kind of renders everything except your 7.5 rifle with a suppressor on it useless. It doesn't matter if you get the best gun in the game or your wee pistol, it's still the same.
Aye, that's true, because, like, if you make an arse of a level in Metal Gear Solid, like 1 to 3, if you know how to shoot your way out to it, it's messy, but you can eventually, like, fucking get them all and then walk out the level. Whereas in this one, they will just literally keep spawning until your guard meter goes down, so you either have to book it to the end of the level, or if you kind of hide, like, you're kind of done for.
I reckon they could have made this game on the ZX Spectrum if they wanted to, and I'll tell you why. See the map? The map is what you're kind of mainly focused on. See the screen? The actual screen with the level on it? I found myself looking at that for combat, obviously, but also primarily to see which way the baddies were looking. The baddies, because it's quite a limited system, the baddies, whilst the sprites are quite detailed, they have a red dot that symbolises their line of sight, so you know what way they're looking, so you can kind of move on. If that was there, you could feasibly just have this map and play the game, I'd imagine. Another thing too I enjoyed about the game was, I was mentioned this earlier, that there's short levels this time. Any Metal Gear game I've played has kind of been, like, long meandering open world sections, but this is just, like, stage 1 complete, stage 2 complete, so you're, like, outside the base in the first level, inside the base in the third level, and then you go underground, etc.
A component of 1 would have been backtracking, where you might be in a lab, the third building, and then Colonel Campbell would be like, oh, in order to beat Sniper Wolf, you're going to need a sniper rifle. You better run back to the tank hangar, which was fucking ages ago. And then you need to backtrack through hundreds of stuff that you'd done previously.
Aye, well, there's none of that in this game. It's just the standard stages. I like how they brought the all getting caught thing, like when you get caught in Metal Gear Solid and you kind of got that music coming on that's all chaos for a second. They've done that quite well in this game. They've managed to bring that over. The evasion counter is still amazing. Pops up big, massive fucking numbers and that and gets your heart pounding. You've got a crazy tune that comes on. You're running about mental. It's really good.
The exclamation mark popping up over the guard seeds.
That's right, and there's plenty of places on the maps where you can hide. For instance, you've still got the lockers. The one I liked was the back of the van. There's vans about, and if you jump into the back of the vans, you might be able to get a wee ration pack to bring your life up, etc. as well. Aye. I quite enjoyed running about. I did find that the levels did get a wee bit samey at times. For instance, there's only so much dodging guys with red dots in their head you can do before it becomes kind of monotonous. However, this was split up by puzzles in the game. There's puzzles such as I mentioned on the group chat before that you could get a cigarette or a vape. And you use this vape in a puzzle to sort of expose beams so you can get past. That's been done in Metal Gear Solid before, isn't it? When you blow stuff on the beams in order to expose them.
The old classic.
That fit my game, The Mission, that we love, we know and love from the podcast. There's other puzzles as well, such as, I think there's like a big massive boat or something that flies past and shoots waves at you, and you've got to time the waves and move yourself through to level as well. There's also a lot of duct sections in this game from what I played. That kind of bring a pace note down a wee bit. I felt like I was wondering about in ducts, like air ducts for ages.
I've got a memory of playing this game when I was a nipper, and a puzzle involved getting into the cardboard box item and then travelling along conveyor belts. But they went in all sorts of crazy different directions, and you had to get on a specific belt and be in the box to go to a specific area.
Mm-hmm. Is that not in Metal Gear Solid 2 as well?
Maybe I'm getting mixed up. They might bleed into each other to an extent.
Aye, but that was definitely in it, aye. Moving about in boxes, which is a kind of staple of these games, isn't it?
Access to a few of these gadgets in that as well for the PlayStation game, which is quite cool.
I like the aspect of having to wear a gas mask, and the only reason was when the gas comes on every 20 seconds in a section in this game. But the screen goes pure mental. You know how when it's on Metroid in the first level, the whole fucking thing starts rocking about and it goes mad colours and all that? What happens in this game as well, where if the gas comes on, it goes all green and it starts going all blurry and all that? It's quite impressive for the Game Boy, I thought. There's also a level where everything goes infrared and you can only see your character moving about in infrared, and it looks amazing on the Game Boy, to be honest with you, that effect. So I think that from a visual point of view, they've done really well here. The animations are good as well. Sometimes on the Game Boy, you get kind of hit and miss animation, but everything was detailed enough in order to kind of manoeuvre about the levels well in this game. I quite enjoyed it. The only thing that kind of stopped me playing it was every level was pretty much the same. You were pitted against these baddies, sprites of which didn't really change much. And you just had to manoeuvre through the levels without getting caught, essentially, within the line of sight.
There's a kind of just like one or two varieties of guard that you're up against.
There's a green one and a blue one, I think. But I found that after a while, man, it was getting really samey. And whilst I really enjoyed the story, for instance, a bit I missed about the story was the lassie Jenna tells you to go off screen to see like this guy lying in a heap. It turns out it's a guy called Hawk. And he has a big 8-minute speech about how he got washed up in Australia and was taken in by an Aboriginal family. And the Yanks had, by that time, assassinated every Aboriginal. And he was therefore left without a family. So he walked the earth, Jules at a Pulp Fiction, to try and find his place in the world. And he found his place in Gindra. It was adopted by the Black Chamber. So he's in a moral quandary. Like, he doesn't want to be in a cult kind of rebel group, but it's the only people that kind of took him in and all that stuff. The game's full of this stuff. I think where this game shines is in its storytelling, more than its gameplay. The engine in which the game is based on is competent, and it's fun to an extent to play, but it doesn't last for... The fun of the aspect of the game, for me, didn't last for more than maybe an hour or two, whereas the story and the visual novel aspect of the game really kind of shone.
There's a fake Metal Gear game, right, called Snake's Revenge. The original Metal Gear came out on the MSX, which was a Japanese microcomputer, and then it was popular. They made a version of it for the Famicom, which then get imported to the West as well. And I think it was quite popular in the West and all. And then there was a fake American Metal Gear sequel. Like how we were talking about Strider 2 last time, how the Strider people had no involvement in that. There is a Metal Gear game that was made purely by Yanks that had no involvement with Kojima or any of them, called Snake's Revenge, which was kind of like the Ramboification of Solid Snake, where they had none of this clever shit in it about people fighting on different sides but being conflicted, and, you know, just a loss of human life and how conflict's pointless. It was just Solid Snake gunning down, you know, the Reds or the Muslims or whoever the baddie of the week was. Ghost Babel, for being a Game Boy Color game that's now considered non-canon, does not seem to be a Snake's Revenge. I don't know if Kojima had a hand on the ball in this. In essence, this is a proper Metal Gear Solid game.
It's non-canon, so it totally ignores the events of Metal Gear Solid 2, because it wasn't out yet. But I think they kind of removed it from canon, because it deals with all this kind of stuff about his liberation front in Africa and all that stuff. And I've kind of done how fun this game is a disservice. I mean, stealth games have never really been my thing, and it does everything well. It just, I find that, you know how I've got to have a game where there's a lot going on the screen, dynamic? There's got to be something that I'm sitting there at the end of the level going, fucking yes!
Aye. Making sound effects and that.
Aye, exactly. I just, by end of maybe level 5 or 6, I found myself going, oh no, right, okay, so this is going to be another green level with green baddies that I've got to avoid, like Plant-Man again. And I kind of get tired of it, aye. Is this going to be an indoor level or an outdoor level that looks exactly the same? That type of thing, you know. There was no real quirkiness. All the characters were in this universe of a visual novel, and were never really in the game you were playing. It was as if it was completely separated from... like the gaming experience, you know.
You think the writing in this outclasses the kind of vehicle it's contained in?
Aye. To use a big word, man, I think there was too much of an incongruence between the writing and the story and what the nuts and bolts of the game was. It was like you could have that game without that story and vice versa.
Aye. Interesting.
Aye. I mean, while it is very impressive with the Game Boy Color, you do get the impression they're running up against the limits of the console as well. There's only so much you can do on it, with like 8 bits and God knows how little memory. I mean, I always thought that Metal Gear Solid actually worked quite well as a 2D game. Like, you would have thought they would have made something like this for the Game Boy Advance or the DS or something. I think that would have worked quite well.
Aye.
And I was acutely aware of that as I was kind of thinking about why am I not enjoying this game so much. They've put so much into what they have that perhaps there wasn't enough space for any sort of kind of added, like, kind of, what you call that, trinkets in order to bring a game some soul, I suppose, or some
bit
fun.
More weapons or more enemy variety, that kind of thing.
Pizzazz, maybe, is the word I'm looking for. Pizzazz. That's like pizzazz, man. You know what I mean? Where's the fucking Metal Gear chasing me? Where's the fucking bosses and all that? Why am I just walking about green and kind of beige-flavoured landscapes for all eternity?
I will say, right, this is good, this is why we do a podcast, because you look at something from back in the day with fresh eyes, how does it hold up? That's what we're all about. I will say, from the point of view of a Metal Gear Solid obsessed Wayne, which I was, I speedran Metal Gear Solid before I knew what speedrunning was. I used to see how quickly I could complete it. Used to be able to do it in like 5 hours or something like that. I loved it that much that when I had the Game Boy Color and it was the era of Pokemon and I saw that Metal Gear Solid had come out on it, I was like, I need to get Metal Gear Solid for my Game Boy. And for me, I liked it. I didn't like it as much as a PlayStation game, but it gave me a Metal Gear Solid hit if I was fucking, I don't know, in the motor on the way to Blackpool, or but other times where you would be sitting as a fucking introverted Wayne playing a Game Boy, it gave me the hit at the time.
Aye, well that's what it's for. It's for fucking about on a go, and it's not meant to be the full kind of thing. My game, I mean the game, I did enjoy the game, but I feel it burnt out. Kind of burnt out on me. That's just my opinion. I mean, there's probably people that fucking love this game. Oh, I know that this game is very rare as well. I mean, I think this cartridge, I think the game, if you've got the box, can go for like, is it £400-£500, man? If you've got the full package.
David Dickinson, tell me how much I can get for the fucking cartridge, because I might have it in my mod files in Greenock.
Metal Gear Solid Ghost Babel cartridge. You're talking about if. Fancy 50 quid. You get 50 quid for it.
I'm keeping it.
50. You get 50 bangers because it's one of them things, cultural relevance versus quality, and it's got both, so.
There we go. Okay, we'll move on to our next game then. Andy, why did you pick X versus Sever for the Game Boy Advance for myself?
I've always been obsessed, but I've always been quite interested in the Game Boy Advance and how it kind of has the tag of being a handheld SNES. One thing a SNES couldn't do, or the Mega Drive for that matter, was those kind of Wolfenstein Doom games without having serious frame rate drops. And this game, X vs. Server, has always been sort of talked about as a game that demonstrated that the GBA was more powerful than the SNES. So, on that basis, I thought I'd give it to see what you thought.
This is something a wee bit different in terms of Game Boy Advance games we've looked at, in that I would say this is one of the few things I can think of that you could call a Game Boy Advance wee piler. See, if you had a GBA, every cunt seemed to have X vs. Server.
I vividly remember walking into game in the Oak Mall, and the Game Boy Advance section was just like wall to wall X vs. Server. It was like the only thing you could buy, pretty much.
Well, I think it's because it was so popular and there was a platinum edition of it or something, and everybody just bought it. Because the Games Magazine's rated it, and you can probably get it for cheap enough.
I got a key thing. I think Games Magazine's came out and. Because this game looked 3D with guns, and at the time when it came out, it was all about Time Splitters and Red Faction and Killzone and all that, wasn't it? And I think this game kind of looked like that a wee bit in the screenshots.
Well,
it's so popular.
I'll get into it. First, what I would say, the other notable thing about this game is that it is a movie tie-in game whereby, I think, in the year of our Lord, 2024, with the benefit of hindsight, we can probably look back and say, I don't know if this is the only instance where the game that is a movie tie-in has become more famous than the movie it was tied in for.
It also came out 10 full months before the film, which is mental.
Aye. I've got a wee bit in my notes about this, but there's two X vs. Sever games. 10 months before, the Studio Crawfish Studios was a developer, I think they were called. Crawfish Interactive, sorry. They worked closely with the studio making the film. So they had access to a fucking early version of the script.
Right.
So if for some crazy reason you're a big X versus Sever, you can experience an early draft of the script by playing the game. Because the game was an unexpected hit, they brought out, very much closer to the release of the film, a second game called Ballistic X vs. Sever, which was what they ended up going for with the name of the title of the film. Terrible fucking title. Ballistic X versus Sever, much more closely followed the film, had the same engine in that as the game. Apparently it's also very good. And also you had Lucy Liu and Antonio Banderas.
I always fucking, when I heard X versus Sever, I don't know how, but see growing up, I always fucking got it mixed up with that. Remember that Echo Unlimited gear at Bear USA and all that? I was fucking, I don't know why, but somebody said, I used to fucking say, I used to have an X versus Sever trackie, and it was it was an X versus, what was that, Echo Unlimited?
Mark Echo.
It's the same sort of fucking thing, isn't it? It's just, it's a terrible fucking title, because you've got to get everything out, X versus Sever.
The syllables, like, don't run into each other very well. So, like, walk us through this title. Like, what does it actually mean?
Just call your film Ballistic, for starters, right? Fine, it's a stupid action film. Just make it a one-word title. I watched the film last night, right? Wow. It is a fucking mess. nonsensical plot, cobbled together. It's about a team-up between X, who is an FBI agent, and Sever, who is an NSA agent. And they kind of go rogue. There's a nano machine that the US government can use to... It's like the CIA heart attack gun, kind of. But they've got it hidden in a child. But basically, it's very hard to follow. Nothing really makes much sense in it. My suspicion is that this was... Do you know in Tango and Cash? It's kind of a cracking action film with Kurt Russell and Sylvester Stallone.
Aye.
They had shot Tango and Cash, and they tried to put Tango and Cash together, and the editors realised Tango and Cash makes nae sense.
Is that no? You're getting mixed up. That's Tango and Cash is fucking Tom Hanks and his dog.
That's Turner and Hooch, my friend. Tango and Cash. Tango and Cash is Stallone and Kurt Russell. As immortalised in Largs and Lucky and Wild. Come on, remember who you're talking to here.
Aye, right. What a game.
Okay, Tango and Cash got to the editing process and they realised Tango and Cash made nae sense. They'd shot some stuff and they were putting it together and they were like, we don't have a film. This is ridiculous. So they got in this legendary fucking, like, the Winston Wolfe of Hollywood editing, who was like, right, smoking fags, like, right, okay, if we put this scene here and we put that scene here, right, we need the actors back in, and we're going to shoot another four scenes where they're just talking in rooms, and I'm going to stitch this together, and I promise you the movie will make sense. And it did. It's not anybody's idea of a masterpiece, but it's Tango and Cash, you know what I mean? It's pretty good. I think that Ballistic X versus Sever, they had shot all this shit and they thought, we'll fix it in post, and then they just never. Because there's no narrative through line in it. You don't feel any stakes when you're watching it. You don't really get to know the characters. There is a lot of slow motion because I think that they were struggling to reach the 90-minute runtime. So they were like, right, just put Lucy Liu in slow motion again. Have her firing a machine gun in slow motion.
Plus, it was 2001. It was like peak Matrix years.
It's not even a so bad it's good film, unfortunately. But yes, the film is shite, but the game, pretty good. Full credit to the developers, Crawfish Interactive, as I was saying. It's good stuff. McCormick, you used a term on this podcast before, which I've come to quite like, which is boomer shooter.
Yeah, this is very much like a Wolfenstein 3D type of thing, isn't it?
Yes, X vs. Sever is a boomer shooter, like Doom, GoldenEye, Wolfenstein 3D, stuff like that. You have a first-person viewpoint, and your character moves like a tank. Now, when I first switched it on, I'm not going to lie, I was filled with a wee bit of dread. I was walking about a level, I found trying to aim kind of cumbersome and awkward, and I was like, oh, this is aged badly. I died a couple of times and that, and I was like, I don't know about this one. But after a wee while, you know the kind of awkwardness that these boomer shooter tank control things, the more you play this one, you get into using the shoulder buttons to strafe.
Oh, really?
And if you hold in both shoulder buttons, you can duck for cover. So X vs. Sever is actually not a bad... I'm not going to claim that it went on to influence Gears of War. Is that what it was called? Gears of War, right. Or Mass Effect 2, those cover shooters?
Yeah.
It didn't influence these things, but with the benefit of hindsight, it doesn't feel a million miles after them sometimes. By the time I had learned to strafe with the shoulder buttons and I was ducking behind cover and that, and I wasn't constantly dying, I was kind of flying through the levels and I found the gameplay loop a wee bit addictive. That one wee innovation with the shoulder buttons really fucking keeps this game on life support from otherwise being a pretty generic, you know, throwback to those kind of games.
Because these are the kind of movements that you could usually do with a keyboard and mouse, and it's like they've kind of found a clever way of getting it to work with just, you know, your four buttons and a D-pad and two shoulders.
McCormick, I was going to ask you about this, right? So, GBA, often cited as a handheld SNES, right? Game Boy Advance, right? Now, SNES could display a sort of kind of pseudo 3D thing called Mode 7, using the scaling to turn a massive sprite into like a plane. Is that right? These games, these 3D GBA games, are using actual real 3D because there's walls and shit.
It's a thing used by like Doom and Wolfenstein 3D. It's called raycasting. It's not really polygonal 3D. It's kind of like a souped up version of Mode 7. You get like 2D sprites, but they've been kind of like transformed and rotated and stuff to... they look 3D. You don't see it so much anymore, but yeah, that's how all your kind of Dooms and that were made, and they managed to pull it off in this. I don't really know much about the technical background of this game, but it does seem quite impressive that they're able to pull that off.
You basically had a GoldenEye that you could play in a handheld, right, for the time.
Yeah.
Very impressive, very cool. Another thing about this that we've come across this in a podcast a few times before as well, whereby my main regret with playing this is that I don't get to experience the multiplayer that you could have played back in the day on X versus Sever. I'm not sure how it worked, but you could play a four-player multiplayer on this. I don't know if there was a link cable that split into four or something like that.
This is always a problem with Game Boy games for me. I mean, this time, 2001, we were getting hairy boys in school and shit, right? Now, can you imagine the four of us all lined up with big fucking... See, Game Boy Advance is bad enough to bring into school, but big link cables... we'd be getting fucking my heads flushed in the toilet in a pee changing rooms, you know what I mean? That's a good point, man. But
what you could do is you could all hide in the different toilet stalls, and then each of you would be sitting on the lav, and then you'd have the connection running underneath the stalls.
Or go to the sanctuary of the music department.
That's actually what glory holes is for. Playing X versus Sever.
That's a fucking great point, by the way, on the multiplayer thing. Like, there's a whole kind of aspect of Game Boy games. Well, have they been fully enjoyed? Because it's just too clunky to get a multiplayer activated.
I couldn't tell you anyone that owned a link cable on either of the Game Boys.
Oh, I did. A lot of people had the link cable on the Game Boy Color to swap Pokemon.
I
got the 150, and I used to battle people on it as well.
But I've never ever seen people with two Game Boys linked up playing something like Peach Rampers Tennis or something. Do you know what I mean? That's just something like this.
At that point, you're as well just playing actual tennis with each other.
But my vision, right, when I'm thinking about... Do you remember playing multiplayer GoldenEye, right?
Ah, brilliant. Brilliant, man.
But also, even the most saintly among us, sometimes, right, you can't help yourself. Your eyes would drift to the other part of the screen, and you might screen cheat a wee bit. You might go... oh, where's Andy? My eyes might drift over to the other part of the screen and go, I know where Andy is.
He's hiding in a bog again.
Well, if you've got your own Game Boy screen, you have got GoldenEye with no screen cheat. And isn't that a wee bit different?
Aye, that's a very good point. It's sort of like a genesis of esports.
I think there's an indie game called Screen Cheat where... every character is invisible unless you're looking at the other person's screen, and the point of the game is that you're supposed to screen cheat, which is kind of fun.
How could it look like a kind of tangible way of getting by that? Would have been maybe he's all wear 3D glasses, and if you look at your own part of the screen, then it gives you a seizure or something.
that's maybe a bit harsh, a penalty for screen cheating.
That's actually the technology the baddies invent in X versus Sever, is the 3D glasses that give you a seizure.
For all I know, it was. And I don't know how you take actors like Lucy Liu and Antonio Banderas, who usually in an action film where they show up, you're like, yes, they're in this. You know, Lucy Liu shows up in Kill Bill, and it's like, oh, fuck, man. The stakes have never been higher. Antonio Banderas in that cool film where he carried that guitar case about that was, like, full of guns. Vintage, cool stuff. To make them in this so fucking widden and nae chemistry between them, it's almost impressive how shite Ballistic X vs. Sever the film is.
It's considered one of the worst films of all time.
Yeah.
You get Roger Ebert fucking giving it 0 stars in that.
It had the lowest Rotten Tomato score of all time for a while.
It was good.
Impressive.
The trouble with recommending X vs. Sever nowadays is I could only really get a recommendation if you were going to play it on a Game Boy Advance or a similar wee handheld emulation device that's a bit like a Game Boy Advance. I played it on the old faithful Chinese Retroid Pocket 2. Again, apologies to Ross Greer. He's probably punching fuck out of war because it's the second time we've talked about China. You need something like that to emulate with a wee screen and the shoulder buttons in order to really get the best of this game, I think. See, if you were playing it on a big screen with a controller or sitting at your PC with a keyboard, I don't think it would feel nearly as nice. You need the satisfying strafing with the shoulder buttons and the Wii screen. If you have that, then this is a cracker, old school FPS. I think trying to play it on your phone would be a fucking nightmare. It would be crap. But unfortunately, due to the nature of games now, it's probably skippable.
That's it. It's been totally overshadowed by DS first-person shooters if you want a portable experience. Games like, there's Call of Duty games on there. I think there's a Metroid Prime game as well on it. There's also things like GoldenEye was ported to it as well. I think it was the original version of GoldenEye. Bionicle Heroes is a good one. So, it's completely overshadowed. This wee game here is just a sort of kind of a technical example of how something almost impossible could be pulled off, I suppose, for the time.
But I mean, I suppose if you're more into the more old school sort of shooters, your Dooms and stuff, then
Wolfenstein.
You'd maybe prefer this.
I like them, and I really enjoyed my time with this. It's
Duke Nukem.
Another example. That it's just that a recommendation for this for me comes with caveats. You need to be able to play something that you can hold in your two horns and strafe with the shoulder buttons, because that's what makes it good.
I've got an absolute belter, but it's another example of 3D GBA games that I want to give you as well. It's down the line, same thing, but it's a 3D like kind of open exploration game, Asterix and Obelix, and it looks like a PS1 game. I just don't know how they do it, man. It's quite fascinating, they pulled off what they did with hardware. Sort of like X vs. Sever.
Interesting. Well, I was an Asterix guy as a way, and I always liked Asterix.
But these games kind of, I don't know what it is. I think it's one of them weird kind of fucking artistic things I've got, where I'm like, oh, fucking 3D on a GBA, but I don't know. It's just, it was weird, man. It's like, the GBA was for Choo Choo Rocket, Sonic Advance, and Mario ports for SNES. It wasn't for that, a full-bodied kind of 3D game, and yet here we are.
That brings us on to our final game of the evening, which is Morrowind for the original Xbox and PC.
Yes, yes!
And now all sorts of other devices. The reason I picked this for McCormick was, much like Super Metroid last year, I just thought, I'll just dish him out one of the best games ever made, shall I? The writing, the world building, everything about this is just next level. I was saying to McCormick before we started recording, I think Oblivion and Skyrim are both good games. I like them. Neither one of them would sneak onto my top 10. Morrowind probably does. There's just nothing else like it. Me and McCormick, we talked about this when we talked about Seventh Saga a couple of years ago now, are also both quite big fans of quite an alien world and a fantasy setting. You know, something that's a wee bit different from everything else. It's not just J.R.R. Tolkien. And then Morrowind, they base a lot of the architecture more on Africa and the Middle East and stuff like that, rather than medieval Europe. And they just throw in a lot of other trippy imagery, big mushroom houses and stuff like that, that when you're walking about it, there's just no other game world like it. And I thought, Mick's either going to love this, or due to how dated it is in some other ways, because that also has to be talked about, he might not like it so much, and that'll also be interesting. So I was just dying to hear how he got on with it.
Aye, so I entered this game with a wee bit of trepidation, because I'd heard from other people that it's pure hard to get into. The combat doesn't work very well. You're going to get murdered by cliff racers within a second of going off the beaten path if you've not built your character correct in that. But yeah, I watched a couple of videos on YouTube kind of getting started with Morrowind and that, and I was after the races. This game starts off very much like an Oblivion or a Skyrim, and I'm going to be comparing these a lot to these games because I think it's different in some like interesting ways. You just come off a boat, you're heading out on your way into this land of Morrowind, and once you've kind of signed off your papers, you get told, oh, there's a guy you might want to talk to, but pretty much other than that, you're just turned loose on the world and just go off and fucking find your fortune, do what you want to do. I was a wood elf called Rex after my internet handle for back in the day. Rex didn't want much out of life other than the simple goal of being the best jumper in the entire world. I wanted to make a guy, because I heard you could do this in this game, that you could build up your stats in such a way that you could jump, just pressing the jump button and soar through the sky fucking thousands of feet in the air. And I just thought, fuck being a wizard or being a warrior or being head of the Dark Brotherhood, I want to jump. So I set off on my journey across the world to learn how to do that. And if I ended up being like a prophesied hero or, you know, head of the Mage's Guild, whatever, that was incidental to my eventual goal of being the world's greatest jumper.
They're just steps on the road to becoming a mega frog.
Exactly, aye. So, rather than the kind of glory sort of frostbitten wilderness of Skyrim, or the kind of lovely green pastures, kind of rolling hills of Cyrodiil in Oblivion, the world that you set out in Morrowind is, at the start, like a giant swamp, basically.
Aye.
It's a big swamp, loads of water, reeds, these giant, huge mushrooms kind of towering over you. You don't see a tree in this game for like maybe the first hour or so until you're in towards the centre of the island of Vardenfell. And the centre of Vardenfell is more of a kind of... it's a giant volcano where the heart of Lorcan, this kind of ancient deity, embedded itself into the ground and created this big magical volcano. So half of it's kind of swampland, half of it's like this kind of ash and sort of barren volcanic landscape, weird lava flows everywhere and stuff like that. So it's a vibe, it's a very unusual vibe and nothing very much like what you'd usually get in a fantasy RPG. Like I was saying, it's very much kind of anti-Tolkien in that sense, which I think was quite intentional for this game.
Aye.
So yeah, it's a weird, strange world, and it's just populated by like not a whole lot really. It's quite a... there's the odd NPC walking about and weird creatures and stuff, but not a whole lot of kind of life and incidental detail. It's kind of like being on another planet. And that sounds like a bad thing, but I liked it. I liked the sort of loneliness you found yourself in the world.
It's also a wee bit like Scotland. I mean, quite a lot of this country is empty. Everyone's quite spaced out.
Aye, because they cut down all the trees to put fucking sheep there.
Aye.
The economy of Morrowind isn't based around sheep, it's based on eggs that people find in caves.
It's Quarma eggs. Do you know, for reading pages and pages of lore on this, getting deeply into the politics of the great houses, embedding myself in the history of this world, knowing a lot about the geography of the region, don't really know what Quarma eggs are. I think they're just food. I don't know why they're so valuable.
Yeah, they restore your fatigue in the alchemy system, but other than that, fuck knows how you can sustain an entire kingdom of them. There's a lot of things that are kind of very weird about this world, that being one of them. Also, these weeds, they sell these fucking weeds, I forgot what they're called. But yeah, you talk to somebody else and that's like, yeah, that's like a massive part of Morrowind's economy as well. So you find out Morrowind is a place, it's home of the Dark Elves. If you're used to your drow and stuff like that from Dungeons & Dragons, the Dark Elves are very much like that.
I mean, the cynics among us might say the exact same. Yeah, other than that, it's not a matriarchal society. they've got like a lot of stuff that the Drow and D&D have, like an assassin's guild that kills people to stop war from breaking out among the great houses, I think is lifted straight for Advanced Dungeons and Dragons, for instance.
I see. Yeah, Morrowind is where they live. You're in a part of Morrowind called Vardenfell, which is an island, as I mentioned, with a big volcano in the middle. It's nominally part of the Empire. When you play Oblivion, you're in the capital of the Empire, which is a kind of human empire, very much modelled after the Roman Empire. But as a province of the Empire, they're kind of autonomous. They pretty much get to set their own laws and stuff like that and continue the way of life that they've had for thousands of years. And they're ruled over by these three folk called the Tribunal. You've got Vivek, Sothasil, and Almalexia, who are these three dark elves who, through a mysterious process, have become like these immortal god kings.
Yes.
And they're basically in charge of the entire place. And according to people you talk to, they're wearing an iron fist. They've got like a secret police that monitors everything the day. But also, on the other hand, apparently a lot of good social welfare programs.
Yeah.
Look after the poor and stuff like that quite well. It's a wee bit socialistic. It's a wee bit like GDR or something.
I've got to admit, I quite liked Vivek. In my playthrough, I joined the Tribunal Temple. I don't like that they persecute the dissident priests. I don't know how far you got in the main quest.
I've not done that much of the main quest. I feel like I've been playing this game for ages. Like, I've been properly addicted to it. I've been playing it with something like 25 hours or something, which is definitely not as much as Mick, but I've not had hundreds of time to play this. For a game that I'm playing on Neddy, that's been quite a lot so far, and I've barely scratched the surface yet. Because there is actually like hunters you can be getting on with. So there's all these different factions you can join. So the political tension in this world is like between the sort of human-led empire and the dark elf society. And the human empire has got all your kind of factions that you're used to from playing something like Oblivion or Skyrim. You've got a mage's guild, thief's guild, fighter's guild. But they've also got counterparts of dark elf society almost. So dark elves are ruled over by a kind of aristocracy of these great houses, they're called.
Yes.
You've got like House Llatu, which are like, they're quite business-minded and they're quite open to the empire because they'll make a lot of money for it.
I'll explain it to you.
Okay.
You've got House Llatu, in Scottish terms, are Campbells.
Right.
They are the sleekest house. They are basically selling out to the Empire, aka the Brits, because it brings them personal wealth.
Yes.
And a way to get ahead. House Redoran are more like the McDonald's. They are traditionalist, they are great warriors, they are honour-bound. The Telvannis, there's only three in Vardenfell. There are more great houses in Morrowind at large, but in the game you're mainly concerned with three. And then there's a secret sixth house, but which we can get into. The Telvannis are just a kind of mad bastard house who don't really fit into anything else. They're full of just crazy, like, immortal wizards. One of the guys, like, clones himself, like, sister wives and stuff like that. They could be Fifers or maybe like the Douglases or something. I really can't think of a good analogue for them, unfortunately.
Well, I like in these games, but I like Fallout, New Vegas, and I like Skyrim. The reason I like them is I like being able to just kill everything, and I like getting stronger and stronger and stronger to a point where I just fucking go and like absolutely pillage villages and all that, and I play it like GTA 5 a bit.
Unlike New Vegas and Skyrim, you can kill everything in this.
Yes!
In New Vegas and Skyrim, you kill somebody who's essential to the plot, they get knocked out for 2 seconds, and they stun up again.
Right.
In Morrowind, the training wheels are off, right? No stabilisers, no kid gloves. You can walk up, you can stab somebody to death, who is crucial to beating the game. A wee message will flash up and say, by the way, you can't beat the game now because you've killed this guy, but you can keep playing if you want. You know, the main quest isn't the be-all and end-all. If you're out to just kill everything, that's what you can do.
I see, that's what I like. I like that. And I like getting all your new equipment and going about and finding stuff. But what I found difficult when I've tried to play this game is I found the... I know it's an older game. You know how you've got that cut-off between like Japanese RPGs and turn-based combat and everything's kind of separate for how the game moves and things? I found that that was kind of present in Morrowind, where it wasn't as dynamic. It didn't feel like a walking simulator. It didn't feel like a real life simulator. It felt more like a storybook that was being converted into something that you could play on screen.
The objective of these Elder Scrolls games, according to Bethesda, is that they've always wanted to convert a tabletop role-playing game experience into an immersive computer game.
Aye.
And in Oblivion and Skyrim, to do that, you swing a sword at something, you hit it, right? Because, of course you have, you've stood in front of it and you've swung your sword and you've hit it. What Morrowind does is closer to the table, whereby you swing your sword at something, a sum is being done in the background based on how good you are at swinging swords, how well armoured the enemy is, all that stuff. And you might miss, even though you're standing right in front of them. So you can have the experience playing Morrowind of standing in front of an enemy, swinging your weapon, and just missing all the time, even though you're like, this doesn't make any sense. I can see the fucking sword going into its head. So that can lead to a wee bit of fucking incongruity.
Aye.
And it is arguably one of the things that's aged poorly about it.
This game came out about the same time as Knights of the Old Republic, not? I fucking love that game. I think it just the world building is great, and I'm sure it is in this game too, but there's something about the presentation of that game, the way the game is sort of fed to you, essentially, that just makes it a lot more appealing to me as a gamer than Morrowind. And I think it might be something to do with the voice acting, the fact there's not as much reading in it.
Knights of the Old Republic is consciously a lot more cinematic. Morrowind is a lot more like an old, hardcore role-playing game. You talk to somebody, you have got a list of topics doing a sidebar, and pages and fucking pages of text. You can sit and read lore in this game for hours, whereas in Knights of the Old Republic, you've got this lovely dynamic voice acting. In Morrowind, you have got voice acting, but as me and Mick were talking about on chats to each other, an NPC might say one or two looping incidental lines before you get in, and then it's just all text. You know, like Walk with Virtue, Outlander, Wealth Beyond Measure, Outlander, stuff like
that. I found myself when I was trying to progress, because I was presenting that much information, I wasn't too sure what to do with it. I wasn't too sure, like, okay, what part of this information do I need to move forward?
Characters just completely lore dump on you. Everyone NPC in this game is autistic as fuck. You'll get, like, a pure info dump of like, any topic that you want. And a lot of that dialogue is kind of shared. Like, the same person will say, like, the same things. Like, if you ask them, like, about what's a Daedra or something, they will tell you, like, the same thing. And there's a bit... As the game goes on, the fucking list of things you can talk to them about is massive. So, one thing you were saying about this game is how the combat feels and stuff like that is quite weird, and it can be a bit off-putting. I think a lot of folk, that's quite a barrier to the game, because the game is very much a role-playing game. Things are based on stats and dice rolls. But I think because this is one of the first of these games where it actually took place in a big 3D open world and it looks like an FPS, folk expect it to play like an FPS, and it doesn't. So you've got to get your head around that. I kind of knew that coming into the game, so I wasn't actually, you know, too bothered by the fact that when I'm swinging my sword, it misses quite a lot of the time. Because I think the combat isn't really the main focus of this, I didn't find. Definitely not as good or dynamic as you get in Oblivion or Skyrim, but I wasn't too bothered by it because I was more interested in kind of building up my character and building up my skills in a way that I wanted and having access to different spells and items and things. And
for how limited the combat feels, and you hit the nail on the head actually at the start of all this chat, we're talking about how you wanted to, all you wanted to do is jump across the map, right? This game has very few restrictions in terms of, it has all these different spells and effects and sort of says, all right, there you go, see what you can do with this. You can fly in this. Like, you can become so overpowered at higher levels that you can fly about the map like a god and rain fireballs down on the ground and just drink potions to replenish your magic as you fucking decimate, like, you know, like you're Israel or something. you can just go mental. You can do anything in this, really, with your character.
And that's kind of the main draw for me. Like, the reason I said that about my character is because I'm not going into this thinking, right, I'm a member of the Mages Guild and I'm going to roleplay as somebody that's, you know, really wanting to be top of the Mages Guild. And that the factions and stuff, how you do your quests, they're interesting, but it's not that deep. Like, there's no kind of rivalries really that affect how the game plays out if you join a certain side or whatever. Like, and that stuff is fun enough, but it's not about the faction system. It's about this kind of sandbox where you can kind of build your character in certain ways and have certain powers that you aren't having, and yeah, effectively turn yourself into a god. Like, that's where I was getting my enjoyment from.
Aye.
The game doesn't really have any limits, like in terms of your stats and stuff. Like, as you're leveling up, you might get an intelligence of like 100 or something, but if you get potions or like magical equipment and stuff, that can go up to like 100,000, and then your like abilities kind of scale like indefinitely. I pretty much quickly decided, like, when I found a few kind of exploits, I was going to turn my character into a god.
If you drink a potion that increases your intelligence by 100, it doesn't just go, right, okay, you've had that potion, you can only do that once. No, you can drink 15 of them and then see what happens. You can drink 200 of them and then see what fucking happens. Everything stacks, it lets you get fucking crazy.
Aye, so that's kind of what I found myself doing, actually, just in my last playthrough there. You've got alchemy in this game, which allows you to, like, find or buy plants in the world. And then you can combine them. They all have like different effects, and if you get two that have the same effect, you combine them into a potion that has that effect. So yeah, intelligence affects how good your potions are, but you can brew a potion that increases your intelligence, and then brew another potion with your newfound intelligence, and then brew another, and then drink that potion and brew another one, and then quickly, you know, once I found a seller that sold two things that improved my intelligence, I quickly managed to get my intelligence up to like insanely high levels, which meant I could brew potions with insanely powerful effects. So I brewed one that gets rid of your fatigue, and it ups your fatigue limit. And I thought what that would do was just basically let me run around indefinitely. But what I found was that, yeah, I could jump and I could sail across the entire map, and I could land without doing myself any damage, just because of the way the kind of maths in this game works.
If you enchant something and put 1 point of slow fall into it, I believe you never take fall damage. So you can jump as high as you want, as far as you want. You never take fall damage. See, in other games like this, I feel like the developers anticipate these things and they put wee things in to be like, oh, nice try, but oh, you'll not beat us. You'll not get outside the parameters of this game. And Morrowind, it feels like they're going, ah, fucking well done, man. Fuck, fill your boots. Getting you a wee wink and a pat in the back. Like, ah, you fucking jump across the map. If you can work that out, mate, go for it.
Aye, it's like you're not forced to play the game the way the developers want you to. You can just kind of break it to hell and back and be like, no, fuck it, this is how I'm going to do things.
Aye.
But fuck using the Silk Striders, like, I'm immortal. I'm going to fucking dive across the entire map, or I'm going to drink a potion that makes me like the strongest man in the universe. I can kill things in one punch and just bypass combat completely. It lets you do that, and that stuff is pretty fun.
I'll tell you one of the things I love about Morrowind, right, is you get off this boat in Vardenfell, Natuna Sedanine, and you go through the Imperial fucking check-in bit. You were in prison. They're going to just turn you loose on the island of Vardenfell. They give you a breadcrumb, and they say, right, you want to do the main quest, go and find this cunt in Balmora called Caius Cossadus. He's in charge of your clandestine operations in Morrowind.
We picked the buffest man in Morrowind and put him in charge of the Blades.
Well, you go and find him, and he's an old man in tracky bottoms who is addicted to crack.
Well, an 8-pack.
He has the greatest abs in the entire land. His whole backstory is that he was supposed to go under deep cover as an addict, but he got too into it. And you ask people in a tune about him, and they're like, aye, Caius Cassadis is a junkie. And then you go to his house, there's spoons everywhere. There's like pipes. There's an illicit substance called moon sugar lying about on the tables and that. And then when you get about halfway through a main quest, Caius is like, ah, look, mate, I'm not going to be here for you anymore. I'm getting called back to the Empire. Like, fucking political nonsense, man. Cunt can't even take a wee toot of moon sugar anymore on the job. It's a joke.
Yeah, it's pretty brilliant. The quests in this game, I found them quite unusual, like comparing to something like Morrowind or Oblivion, where there's a lot of kind of scripted stuff going on. Like, if you're doing a quest, you know, certain things might happen at certain times, or, you know, there might be a wee twist or something. I did a quest for House to Vanity, it was the Mage's Guild, and they say, right, there's this woman, she's wanting escorted from this pub to the boat. So I'd go and escort her. And I'm like, right, I've played video games before. I know exactly what's going to happen here. I'm going to get halfway across to where this is going. And all of a sudden, she's going to get set up on by bandits. And I'm going to have to save them.
Some local toughs will pop up. They'll not be in the game beforehand, but they will spawn now.
So I went to talk to this the high elf woman. She's like, all right, lead the way. I walk through the toon. I walk to the docks. I drop off at the ship. She's like, right, thanks very much. See you later. That was literally all they wanted me to do.
But this is also good, right? Because when you first join the Mage's Guild, the missions they give you are shite. Like, you're not going to get to go into Dwemer Ruins and investigate fucking ancient mysteries when you are a lowly novice.
Yeah, you're going to pick up some mushrooms.
Yeah, exactly. Go and find me 5 different types of mushrooms and bring them back so I can make a potion.
Go and buy me this book for the bookshop.
Yeah, exactly.
Is it just the same as like Skyrim in Oblivion where you get quests that you can do and you can choose which quest to do? You can either go to main quest or you can go to side quests and all that stuff.
Aye.
And you can get yourself lost in a side quest to a point where you don't even want to play a main quest anymore. Is it the same sort of idea, right?
The first quest for the Mage's Guild in Skyrim is like, go down to this dungeon and then you find yourself embroiled in like an ancient mystery involving the Psijic Order. Whereas in this, your first mission is to go and find some floors and the next one's to fucking borrow a book for the library and that. It's all like the grunt work that you would be doing if you'd only just joined this organisation. But that's weirdly like kind of immersive. Like, the fun stuff is the stuff that happens along the way.
Ah, right.
It's side quest heavy, I would say. Like an Oblivion or a Skyrim or whatever, if you just plough through the main quest, you have missed the point in these things, you know what I mean? It's about getting lost in the journey and then everything else.
Aye. And there's like even more of that stuff than there is in Skyrim and Oblivion, where the quests are a bit more complicated. And I do love like some of those quests, like the Dark Brotherhood in Oblivion. One of the best like storylines in all of gaming. Like that twist, man, that you never seen coming. Brilliant.
Aye.
But with this, there's like a lot more organisations and factions and just kind of things today and a whole wealth of just wee bits and bobs that you're doing. It just kind of gives you an excuse to walk to this other part of the map and see a new toon, speak to a new person. You might stumble across a dungeon and then, oh, what's in here and all that. So it's just kind of really giving you an impetus to explore this kind of cool world.
You know when you get to a new area in Morrowind for the first time? Like when you get to Vivec, the God King Vivec also lives in a city named after him, right? Which is pretty on brand for Vivec. But you get somewhere like that and you're like, fuck me, this place is massive. How are you meant to know where to go in these places? Like, this is crazy, you've not got any quest markers or that. Isn't it? Right? What have modern games done to us? They've turned us into babies. See quest markers and that? You don't need them. Don't need them. You can follow basic instructions. You can learn the layout of a toon in a game pretty fucking quickly. You don't need all this stuff. It just babies you. Turns you into just like a dog fucking chasing a ball or something like that. It takes the thinking out of things, I think, modern quest design in games.
Aye. You want to go and get a quest and then like all of a sudden it's like, oh, there's a big red X in your map and there's turn markers like there is in Grand Theft Auto or something. Like, that's what you would get in, like, pretty much every modern open-world game. It's going to be like, right, you need to go to Tel Vos, so what you need to do is you need to get the Silk Strider to Sedanine, and then you need to go west, and then you're looking for a guy in the pub, and, like, the pub's on the corner of the street and all that. It's, like, literally just giving you the instructions and where to go, but it is just more immersive. Like, you have to actually think about things like that. And I did find myself being quite intimidated by that. And also, fuck Wolverine Hall. I hate that place. I always get lost in it. But I do know Balmoral at the back of my hand now, for example, just from experience. One thing I noticed is that it's like those old medieval towns. You know how, like, the pub had a sign outside with people that couldn't read? Like, if it was called, like, the Lion's Head or something, pub has a name like that because the sign outside would be a picture of Lion's Head. Most people couldn't read, so they just looked at pictures. Like, most shops have pictures outside saying what they do, whether it's like an armourer or a healer or something like that. They've got like wee...
Armourer will have like an anvil and a hammer, and like the bookshop will have a picture of a book. Mage's Guild has a cool fucking mystical eye. Stuff like that.
And like, that's another kind of weirdly immersive thing as well, because most of these games, like, you know, oh, brilliant, I found this like magical diamond or something, I'm going to go to the shop and sell it for 10,000 gold. You take it to the first shop you go in, it's like, you've got to buy this diamond for 10,000 gold. Well, number one, I sell clays. I'm not going to buy a diamond, have you? And number two, I don't have 10,000 gold. So, like, you're like, oh, well, who am I going to fucking sell this to? You never found yourself being particularly loaded because you're always asset rich and cash poor because you can't fucking sell all your best stuff.
Did you find yourself exploiting Creeper very much?
Who's that again?
Right, in Caldera, which is one of my least favourite towns because it's an imperial settlement and it looks like a town in Oblivion or something. It looks like a Middle-earth town, a wee bit like Ebonheart.
Yeah.
In Caldera, there is a manor called Gorak Manor, which is just where all these orcs live, and they kick about like taps off, going, "Oh, fine day to you, warrior," and stuff like that. And upstairs in Gorak Manor, there is a wee monster called Creeper, who is a merchant, and he always has 5,000 gold on him, and because he is a monster, has no barter system built into him.
Right.
So he will always give you the maximum cash value for what something is worth. So, you know, if you find like a cool knife and you take that to a shop and then a shopkeeper, your inventory might tell you that it's worth 4 grand, but a shopkeeper might go, "I'll give you 2,500 for this."
Because he doesn't like you very much.
You try to haggle with him and get the stuff up, and then they might go, "Nah." Creeper will just always give you 4,000 gold for it. I use Creeper quite a lot to sell off all the high value items I had. I was very rich by the end of my game.
This is the kind of duality of this game because it's got all this stuff which kind of adds the immersion and stuff, but also on the other side, there's like a reasonably easy hack or trick
for everyone
to just bypass it if you can't be arsed being immersed anymore. It's one of the kind of unusual, like, hard to describe things about this game, which actually makes it quite cool. And I think, like, it's a weird balancing act, and I feel that with Morrowind going on to Oblivion and then on to Skyrim, they've added stuff which on paper sounds like a good idea, and a lot of the time it is a good idea, it's an improvement, but somehow along the way of improving the game, they've kind of made it worse in certain ways, or they've lost something that makes Morrowind Morrowind.
They've made it more accessible, for sure. Right, and I think, in for instance, things like Oblivion, although I ultimately don't like it as much as Morrowind, I don't think the world is nearly as interesting. I don't think overall the writing, the lore, the main quest, or anything like that is as good. Oblivion probably has better quest designs.
Yeah.
Like, there is like an H.P. Lovecraft based quest. There is a town that's called something like Innsmouth, right? It's not called Innsmouth, but it's called something that sounds a wee bit like Innsmouth, and a merchant there has gone missing, and you find this fucking cult that worships great old ones, and it's like every cunt in the town, and you need to go about and find it, and there's no map markers in it for that. It's very good. Or like, there's another quest in Oblivion when you go inside a painting, because there's this guy that paints masterpieces, you know, he's like Penny Creole and his brush brings things to life. Morrowind doesn't have any quests quite as cool as that, or like the Morag Tong, for instance, which is the Dark Brotherhood of Morrowind, you know, really doesn't have as good a quest line as the Dark Brotherhood does in Oblivion. Doesn't have that cool twist or anything, sorry. You are just an assassin for hire who is neutral and great house matters, and it's more about role-playing.
Yeah, the quests in this are just really, like, go here and do this, and, like, nothing is going to happen along the way other than what you make of it. So, I've talked a lot about the kind of the world and the nature of how you progress in it and stuff like that, and that contributes a lot to this just really unique vibe that Morrowind has. But the other thing that contributes to the vibe in a way that you don't really see in other Elder Scrolls games is the lore of this game. And
yes.
If you're a loreheed, Elder Scrolls is possibly the ultimate of all video game lore, I think.
You had this fella, Michael Kirkbride, who really would be rivaled perhaps only by the guy who made Echo the Dolphin.
Yes!
Who took like DMT and went in immersion tanks and stuff like that.
That was a fucking great story, man. Brilliant.
Apparently, Michael Kirkbride wrote the religious text in this game called The 36 Lessons of Vivek, Vivek being one of the god kings of Morrowind. Apparently, he wrote them on mushrooms. He was the guy that really spearheaded all the lore for this. And this is another part of the game that might frustrate some players, is that a lot of it is unclear. that you just have to kind of decide what you believe to be the events of the game. As Mick was saying, there is a god's heart in the centre of Ardenfell called the Heart of Lorcan. Hundreds of years before the events of the game, there was a great hero of the Dark Elf people called Indoro Nerevar, who was like Michael Collins or William Wallace or something like that. It was class. Everybody just loved him. And then, unclear how it happens, he is betrayed and dies. And Vivek, Almalexia, and Sothasil use the heart to make themselves gods. Another one of his pals, Dagoth Ur, who ends up becoming the main baddie, he betrays him or not, depending on what you feel about it. They have this big war with the dwarfs, the Dwemer, who disappear because they've been using the heart to try and build their own god. Or you don't really know what happens to them. You never get a clear answer for what happens to the dwarfs either. It's just fucking... it's all a bit high concept, do you know what I mean? Nothing is neat. I have played through the main quest of this game twice, and I've got my own ideas about what I think is going on, but really nothing is spelled out for you.
So one of the things that Michael Kirkbride has said, and this is one of the things that kind of sets apart the lore of the Elder Scrolls, is that if you look at, like, the world of, you know, any other game or whatever, you can kind of put it into, like, one straightforward narrative, like, in the beginning this happened, in year X this happened, in year Y that happened. Whereas kind of like real history, and especially like real world religion, there's multiple different perspectives. There's events that definitely happened, but everyone, due to their worldview, kind of has a very different, like, view on it, a different take on it. And you only ever see, like, this lore presented to you. It's not like an omniscient narrator. It's like always a source has wrote about it or something. Like real history, you've got, like, primary and secondary sources. But aye, everyone that writes about, you know, certain occurrences that happened brings their own baggage and their own biases to it, which means you never fully know what happens at certain times. Like, a good example of what this is, like, when they talk about the kind of creation of the world, in the humans, the way they tell it, gods created humans and elves and everything and set them loose on the world and then just told them to go forth and multiply. We're giving you this gift of the earth and, you know, go forth and expand. So that's kind of led them to have this worldview of, like, you know, we're going to start an empire and we're going to expand across the world. Whereas the elves, they believe that they used to be gods and they were betrayed and there was a kind of great betrayal and they had to lose their immortality and become mortals. So their view on life is very anti-material. They kind of want to go back to heaven and they think that the earth is, like, impure, and that's kind of influenced their worldview. So, like, potentially the same thing happened, but two different views on it. Another kind of interesting thing about the lore of this world is that there's a kind of fourth wall breaking, like, element to it as well.
You're talking about achieving chime?
Yeah. One of the ways you can interpret, like, Vivek and Amalexia and Sothasil becoming gods is that they've realised they live in a computer game, effectively, and that they realise that how they can break the rules of the game to become gods. There's another thing they talk about as well called a dragon break, which is like, if you play a game that's got multiple endings, and then there's a sequel to that game, it's like, well, which ending happened then? It couldn't have been all of them. In any other game, they kind of just pick one, and then they pick a new starting point, and then that's what the sequel is. But in the world of the Elder Scrolls, it's kind of like they all happened, and like something weird happened with the timeline, and then the gods had to kind of smash all these timelines back together again and resolve it.
Daggerfall has five different endings, yeah. And Morrowind, they all happened somehow.
Emberhangs in, like, different and contradictory ways and stuff like that. They bring that into the MMO as well, Elder Scrolls Online, because there's a million players all doing their own storyline. It's like, which one's canon? Well, weirdly, they all are. So Michael Kirkbride, he's stayed a few of his influences. Borges was one of them, which is where a lot of this kind of meditational stuff comes in from. He was a big fan of Gene Wolfe, who wrote a series called The Book of the New Sun, which is another fantasy series, which is very weird and a lot of dense with a lot of symbolism and stuff like that. I read it as a teenager and I couldn't have tell you a single thing that happened in it, to be personally honest. It went completely over my head. And Dune as well. He said he was a big Dune fan. Aye. It's all like a kind of, well, literary fiction, but also the kind of weirder side of fantasy, which, you know, you kind of lose a wee bit. He left Bethesda and worked as an independent contractor shortly after that. I think apparently he fell out with Todd Howard, the lead designer who still was head of Bethesda even up to now.
I'm not surprised. It got safer after fucking Kirkbride left, right? You would not have one of the all-powerful god characters in an Elder Scrolls game now being intersex. But you read about Vivek, you talk to Vivek and that, and Vivek is like, yeah, I've got male genitals and female genitals, which comes from this old, like, thing about, like, the divine masculine and divine feminine.
And so this all culminates in the sort of ultimate work of lore, as these books, got the 36 Lessons of Vivek, that are written like these fucking mystical texts, and they're full of, like, weird kind of wording and illusion and stuff like that, and it's I still kind of get my head around them, to be perfectly honest, but I really do enjoy reading them. I couldn't tell you a single thing that happened in them, because Michael Kirkbride was clearly on another.
Gotta go faster, faster, cheesy, faster.
I should point out, by the way, that picture in that story about Todd Howard not knowing where Michael Kirkbride was, and he went to his house and he was just lying on the floor, he's not on mushrooms, writing 36
Lists of
Vivek.
Yeah.
Apparently never happened. He doesn't really like that story, because is that kind of hack idea, like, whoa, this story's mental, it must be written on drugs and that, and he's like, that, you know, I'm just a creative guy.
It's part of the meta fucking narrative around it. Michael Kirkbride says, I think he claims that he wrote them drunk, not on mushrooms, that he liked drinking bourbon, and he might have been influenced a little bit by the bourbon, but that was it.
Yeah, so as funny as that story is, I thought, out of respect for him, I had to set the record straight.
I like perpetuating the myth. I think that's my Morrowind.
Yeah, no, I know. I'm an unreliable narrator. Maybe a dragon break happened. Who knows? Maybe they all happened.
This thing about Vivek being like intersex is like, I watched a video on this, right? And it turns out that as a symbol of divinity, like in pre-Christianity, this was very common. You know, if you look at Baphomet.
Yeah.
Baphomet is always depicted with a pair of tits and, like, a willy. Before Baphomet became, like, a stand-in for the devil, when it was, like, a god or whatever, it was, like, it had, like, man parts and woman parts, because this was, like, godly or divine or something like that, which is, I think, why they put it into Vivek.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a lot of, like, real-world religion in there and kind of pre-Christian sort of mythology and stuff like that. I think that's the stuff he was really into, was, like, you know, actual mythology and comparative religion and stuff, and he included that. It kind of all feeds into the story. There was, like, lore and stuff about gods and Daggerfall, but apparently when he became lead writer, he was like, none of that stuff fucking makes sense. I'll fling it all out the window. Your gods are rubbish. And I'm fucking starting again from scratch.
You've got the Imperial cult that you can do a quest line for in Morrowind, who follow their own gods, but it's not as interesting as following the tribunal gods and learning all the fucking weird Vivek stuff and going on, like, pilgrimages and stuff like that. I did all the quests and they're fucking great, man. The writing in them was tremendous.
Aye. Yeah, I'm pretty addicted to this one. As I said, I've still got hunters today. I'm still kind of barely scratching the surface. I've only got done a couple of quests for each organisation that I'm part of. I'm going to keep at it. I've really enjoyed this game. A definite recommendation for me, I would say, try and go in it without too many preconceived ideas of what it is. You might put yourself off, you know, thinking too much about it. I would just kind of go in. If you like our role-playing games, if you like open-world games, just kind of immerse yourself in the world and if you find yourself enjoying it. It's not for everyone, but I think if you kind of meet it halfway, you will end up really enjoying it. And there's a huge community as well. Like, if there is things that annoy you about it, definitely somebody's made a mod of it. There's, like, an open source version, which I'm playing, called OpenMW, which, like, is much better to run in modern PCs and runs no bother at all. I'm actually tempted, after this is finished, I've been Googling how to make Skyrim more like Morrowind. And basically there's, like, a whole load of mods you can install that kind of restore some of the stuff in Morrowind, like spellcrafting and some of the spells you can use in the progression systems and, like, new quest markers. People just tell you where things are in that. I'm kind of tempted to do that, but I do still feel that I've got a good couple of 100 hours left of Morrowind before I start on that endeavour.
I'm through the main quest. I've put down the Sixth House and the menace that is Dagothar. What I'm doing new in the game, as well as playing the expansions, slavery is legal in the world of the Dark Elves, right? It's not a happy pretty fantasy world, right? It's a fucking horrible fantasy world in a lot of ways. Yeah. There's legalised slavery. They enslave the lizard people and the cat people. My guy is kind of like the dark elf John Brown. I have been violently abolitionist. I've been working my way through a Morrowind wiki and trying to save every slave that is in Vardenfell. And because I've finished the main quest, it doesn't matter who I murder now, they can't affect the timeline or the storyline anymore. So that's what I've been enjoying then. And it feels like unfinished business for the last time I played it. But I could play this and talk about it for us. If you've got a deep kind of Asperger's in you for stuff like this, just come and meet us in the land of Vardenfell. Message me about it. Get into it, because I will indulge you. And you will end up having to indulge me for many years. I guess that wraps it up for Morrowind. What we've got for you next time. Now, we are no usually overly sentimental in terms of a popular figure dies, you know. We wouldn't be ones clambering over ourselves to do a tribute. We're not usually that reactive. But I think the bold Akira Toriyama and the imprint that he left on video games, no, even directly, like even fucking if you look at like Supersonic, Sega just lifted his thing and everybody was cool with it because it's cool as fuck.
Yeah, Dragon Ball Z looms large over not just anime, but fucking, yeah, literally every game.
Literally every game. Dragon Quest being such a behemoth over JRPGs as well. We're doing an Akira Toriyama special for you next. While Andy Mack is away doing a pish, he is going to be covering The Legacy of Goku 2 on the Game Boy Advance, which is a top-down GBA action RPG for you. I'm going to be looking at a Dragon Quest game to give you another angle on the Akira Toriyama stuff, because we kind of did Chrono Trigger because we have famously already covered that in an episode called Final Fantasy spelt with PHs. I'm doing Dragon Quest, one of the DS remakes. I can't remember if I'm doing 5 or 6. I found a cheap copy of it on eBay, so I'll get into that next time. McCormick, what have you got for us?
I'll be playing Dragon Ball Z Budokai 3, which is a fighting game which comes highly recommended from Aero, who is a resident Akira Toriyama scholar.
I might even get him to do a voice note or some input in the episode, because he is the master scholar on this stuff. Aye, all that's left to say for me is up the work, girls, praise Vivek.
Reach heaven through violence.
Gotta go faster, faster, cheesy, cheesy, pasta.
See you later.